We get things underway this afternoon by welcoming back to the show the author of more than a dozen books, investigative journalist, and I think the premier expert out there on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy 55 years ago tomorrow. Gerald Posner joins us. Gerald, thanks so much for being with us.
Rich, great to be with you again. I appreciate it.
Well, 55 years have gone by, and yet in the minds of a lot of Americans, still some lingering doubts about who really killed John F. Kennedy. Why is there still so much doubt all these years later?
Now, I think in part the case itself certainly has created question marks that will never be resolved, because you have an instance in which the person accused of being the assassin is killed 2 days after the assassination by a Dallas nightclub owner who is potentially tied to the mafia, and boy, you're off and running. So Oswald never gets his day in court. We never hear the facts. We only get an official report a year later. People are suspicious from the get-go. And then there were a lot of unanswered questions about the shots and whether they could be made. And although those have been resolved over the decades, I think they lingered. Oliver Stone, of course, comes out with his film in the early 90s. We tend to believe in conspiracies more nowadays, between Watergate, Vietnam, Iran-Contra, and everything else. And so I think that it still is a large part of the American public that says, I'm not sure who did it, but I know it couldn't have been one guy.
Your book, Case Closed, really agreed with many of the conclusions of the Warren Commission. But because of the timing of the commission, did that actually in some ways tend to fuel the conspiracy theories?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it is interesting that the Warren Commission is much maligned. And on some things, they did get a few major things wrong, such as the sequence of the shots. I'm now convinced that the first shot scientists and forensics experts and ballistics experts can show is the one that missed the president. The shooter, Oswald, had about 11 seconds to make the shots, as opposed to the 5 seconds the Warren Commission thought. There were things on the autopsy that was wrong, but they got the basic conclusion right. The problem was that when they came out with their official report, they then closed the process up. They sealed documents at the Kennedy family's request for 25 and 30 years. Those weren't released until the 90s. And they also had no follow-up organization in place to answer questions as they came up. So as conspiracy theories sprouted, there was nobody to answer them. They sort of lived on their own, and they continued to spread. People changed their testimony. And I think that Warren Commission, deserves in the end, although I criticize it on some things, a pretty big acknowledgement for having done an amazing job of getting to the truth at a difficult political time.
Now, the House Select Committee that got together, I believe in the late 70s, concluded that there was a possibility of another shooter. A lot of this was based on some of the audio analysis, but most of that has now been debunked.
Yeah, you know, it was unfortunate for them, because the House Select Committee actually did a great job from 75 to 78, almost a 3-year investigation. Bill Blakey was the counsel who ran it, and he's sort of the father of the RICO Act, for those who know that. It's the big criminal act that's used to bring down mob families and all. And they did a great job, and what I say, they debunked a lot of the conspiracy theories that had grown up from the time the Warren Commission report came out in 64 until they started their work more than a decade later. But the problem was that near the very end of their investigation, in late 77, they came across these audio tapes that they believed had been on a Dallas police motorcycle at the time of the assassination. And if that was true, maybe they recorded inadvertently the sounds of the assassination themselves. Now, if you listen to them, there are no sounds on it at all. But they gave it to a couple of sound experts from Long Island who said, we see some supersonic little jots here and there in an 8-second sequence that seemed to us these supersonic jots on a soundboard. You can't hear them, but they're there. Those must be the shots. There are 4 of them, and therefore it's a conspiracy, because Oswald only has time for 3 shots. They were wrapping up their investigation. They didn't have time for further probing it or testing it. They came out with the conclusion that it was likely there was an assassination conspiracy because of that conclusion. And that was, as you said, later debunked. National Academy of Sciences, other independent researchers, independent boards have come forward. It turns out that that tape was recording a piece of sound about a minute after the assassination at a completely different location than Dealey Plaza. So it's the one big error, but it's the one everyone remembers.
We're talking with author Gerald Posner here on Downtown. You've said before there was a cover-up, but it was not a cover-up of the murder. It was a cover-up of some of the other activities that were going on, particularly in regard to the CIA.
Yeah, you know, I do think that the FBI and the CIA deserve some fair amount of criticism here. I mean, the FBI did its job in doing the whole investigation, but both agencies and the Bureau, they lied to the Warren Commission. The FBI destroyed evidence. They destroyed a note that Oswald had left at the FBI Dallas field office telling an agent to stop bothering his wife and him because they were afraid that, oh, my God, we have a note from the guy who was just accused of killing the president, and we didn't do anything about that. They flushed it down the toilet. The FBI also did its best under J. Edgar Hoover to distance itself from Oswald, meaning that they didn't want anyone saying, by the way, you're the vaunted FBI. Why didn't you know that this fellow was a potential threat to the president and he was working along the route that the motorcade was going past? So Hoover backpedaled on that. The CIA, on the other hand, hid information and lied to the Warren Commission because they were afraid that the commission would uncover the CIA's plot to kill Castro in league with the mafia. So all of that was held back. And as a result of protecting their own bureaucratic reputations, they did a great disservice to history. So when researchers started to pick up the hints of some of those lies and obfuscation, and they said, yeah, there's a cover-up here. It must be the cover-up of a murder. It must be the cover-up of their own role in killing Kennedy. They were right. It was a cover-up, but it wasn't the cover-up of a murder. It was instead this, what I call, protect your own behind cover-up of bureaucracies. And that has come out since, but it's not a great moment in American institutional behavior or transparency.
So if Oswald was not a tool of the Russians or the Cubans or the CIA, why did he kill John F. Kennedy? What drove him to that?
I think that's the great question, motivation. What puts him in the sixth floor window shooting at the president that day? It's what the Warren Commission, by the way, failed to do. They just dealt with the facts. They didn't give you any motivation. The Lee Harvey Oswald that I came to understand, Rich, could have been, I know this may sound strange to some of your listeners who aren't delved into the assassination very deeply, could have been in the sixth floor of a building in downtown Moscow on November 22nd, 1963, shooting at Nikita Khrushchev. What I mean by that is, yes, he was a leftist. He had gone to Russia. He had defected after he had gotten out of the Marines. He believed that communism was the pure path forward, but he was completely alienated and turned off by the Russian form of communism. He came back to the United States with his Russian wife, hating Russia as much as he hated the U.S., and that's why he was trying to get to Cuba, where he thought the new revolution under Castro was the pure form. He thought that his contribution to history was going to be to kill a right-wing military army general, Edwin Walker, right, who was running for the governorship of Texas. He had tried to kill him in 63. He failed when the bullet deflected off a window frame. So Oswald's a man who thinks he's going into the history books for killing General Walker and stopping a right-winger from becoming the governor of Texas. All of a sudden, he comes back from being rejected by the Cubans and the Soviet missions in Mexico City to get down to Havana. He wants to get to Havana. They won't let him. They reject his applications. He comes back to the U.S. a defeated person. His wife is living away from him. He's separated from her. He lands a job at the Texas School Book Depository through friends of his wife. And lo and behold, 3 days before the president's arrival, the motorcade routes are mapped out and put on the front page of the Dallas papers. This was history given to him in a silver platter. He is throwing a wrench into the machinery of government. This is Lee Harvey Oswald standing up to all the fellows in the Marines who thought he was gay and threw him in the showers and called him Mrs. Oswald, all the kids who used to beat him up and bully him when he was in school, all the employers who fired him over the years and thought he was useless and not very bright, all the Russian emigres in Dallas who shunned him because he had been in the Soviet Union, all the people in New Orleans who didn't take one of his membership applications for his Fair Play for Cuba. He was going to stand up, throw a cog into the machinery of government, none bigger than JFK's death, and say, I did it. I'm somebody. And here we are 55 years later, still talking about him. From his perspective, he won, as terrible as that is. This is what he wanted, and he did it.
I've always been fascinated by the fact, Gerald, that just a few weeks before Dallas, President Kennedy spoke here at the University of Maine, and security was unbelievably intense. They cleaned out the woods surrounding the football field. Dormitories were emptied. Curtains were drawn. The president flew in on a helicopter, landed on the football field, and walked only a few feet to the podium. All of this intense security in remote northern Maine, and yet 3 weeks later, they put him in an open car in Dallas where there had been threats made, where there had been an attack earlier on Adlai Stevenson. Why the reason for that lapse in security?
Boy, Boy, I'll tell you, you know, I never realized that somewhere in the Secret Service algorithm back then that was manually done for figuring out dangerous spots, that Northern Maine was a much more dangerous spot than Dallas. I looked at the JFK, what I call political tours, as they were coming up during '63, because as politics were moving into higher gear, and they were a mix, as you said, of very good security in places that are odd at times, like Maine, and terrible security, mediocre security in Chicago. But one of the worst security was right before Dallas, and that was in Miami. In Miami, in an area in which the anti-Castro Cubans, essentially, and many people thought they were involved in the assassination, they hated Kennedy. They thought he was a traitor for what had happened at the Bay of Pigs and calling off the military supply. They had the president in an open car, again, going in from the Miami airport into Miami itself, moving around town in an open car. You know, it's like walking Timothy McVeigh at 6 feet, 3 inches tall in an orange jumpsuit out of the prison when he's first there arrested. Mm-hmm. It's like saying, take a shot at him. And it's remarkable to me that nothing happened in Miami, but in Dallas it clearly did. And the Secret Service was fortunate it hadn't happened before, because the security in that sense was not anything like what we're accustomed to after. We are always reactive. We reacted to the Kennedy assassination by never again having a president in that type of open motorcade, although every time we see a president, even post 9/11, get out during a campaign, you know, they do those stops now along the way coming from the airport in some city, and they're supposedly no one knows where, and they'll get out and mingle with the crowd. You know, the Secret Service is having a mild heart attack, because there's no way ultimately to protect a public figure in that type of crowd.
I just had a question. Get your opinion. Do you think that the idea that just one man, because, you know, that seems to be his motivation, was to change history, the idea that one man couldn't possibly change history is what has sort of driven the popularity of these conspiracy theories over the years?
I think that's a great point. And, you know, it was made in an analogy by William Manchester, who wrote the book The Death of a President. Jackie Kennedy was the only person he ever cooperated with. And he said that in, for instance, like World War II, the Holocaust, on one side you have 6 million dead Jews in concentration camps. They're the victims. On the other side you have the Nazis, the worst villains, impossible criminals. There's some balance. Horrible crimes, Holocaust. On the other hand, horrible criminals. With the Kennedy assassination, on one side of the scale, it's exactly what you were saying. You have this charismatic young president with so much potential for the future. We look at the Zapruder film, the home movie of that day, and you see Jackie Kennedy in that little pink Chanel suit and sitting next to the president, and he's vibrant, and there's hope that Camelot is taking us someplace. And on the other side of the scale, you have this just-turned 24-year-old sociopath who's got a cheap rifle, who's been a loser in life, and puts himself into a window and not only shoots at the president, but pulls it off. And you can't quite believe it. So if you can put, it doesn't balance the scale just with Oswald. If you can put something else on the Oswald part of the scale, it was a conspiracy to kill the president because he was going to disband the CIA. He was going to pull us out of Vietnam. He had made enemies in Russia. The Cubans were furious because he was trying to kill Castro. Whatever it is, the mob wanted him dead because Bobby was going after the mob. It makes his death doesn't seem like it's in vain. Otherwise, if it's just Oswald, you feel like it's a useless death. And I understand emotionally why people have great difficulty accepting that.
There are conflicting reports about how many documents remain unclassified by the government. Do you think there's anything of value there in those last documents that we still have not seen?
I think that the value in the documents we haven't seen. So it's always interesting because these are the things they're really holding on to. In some cases, it may turn out to be because they now have a possibility of releasing them in the next year with redacting the names of anybody who's still alive. What they were worried about, there was a series of documents coming out of Mexico City, which is where Oswald traveled just 6 weeks before the assassination, trying to get down to Cuba. There's always been questions about how much the CIA gave of those documents and how much they didn't, because the CIA was obviously had Mexicans in the police force and maybe in the government or young Mexican students who later went on to become prominent citizens who were informants for the CIA. The Mexico City was a hotbed of spies between the Russians and the Cubans and the Americans. Disclosing those names and saying that somebody had helped the CIA, even though it was now 55 years ago or 60 years ago, would not be the best thing for these 75 or 80 year old Mexicans who are either retired now or still prominent in the community. So I understand taking their names out, but the document should be out entirely. And what I think they will show is the extent to which the CIA did really lied about Mexico City, because it protected itself, meaning that it said there was no tape of Oswald going in, no videotape, even though it had cameras on the front of the Soviet embassy. They weren't working that day, supposedly. I think that they just buried everything from Oswald because they were trying to protect their sources. And in doing that, they created doubts about the assassination that have lingered for 50 years. That's unfortunate. And that's what I think those documents will do. I think they'll be very embarrassing to the agency, in particular to the CIA.
Gerald, very excited to see that you've got a new book coming out next year. Can you talk a little bit about American Big Pharma?
That would be great, Rich. I'll tell you, if I could get it out next year, I'd be in good shape. But I will turn in my first draft of the manuscript, hopefully by the end of the year, to my publishers at Simon & Schuster. And we may make it by the end of next year, but if not, it'll be early 2020. It will be the history of the American pharmaceutical industry. It will get you up to the current day. And as I did with the Vatican, my last book was God's Bankers in 2015. It was a 200-year history of the finances of the Vatican and brought you up to the current time. I'll find something interesting in there. My wife, Tricia, who works with me and writes as well, did a book last year on Auschwitz and the pharmacist there. She's working with me on this. We've come up with some brilliant little nuggets of information that I think people will find quite fascinating. It's not all bad. There's some innovation in this story. There's some heroes and there are some villains. It's a human interest story, and it covers both spectrums.
Well, we're looking forward to it. And as always, a real pleasure for us to talk with you. Gerald, thanks so much for joining us. Very happy Thanksgiving to you and your family as well.
Yeah, very happy Thanksgiving to you as well. I tried to look up before I came to talk to you how many times the Kennedy assassination has fallen on Thanksgiving. I couldn't find that. I know that in 63, when he was killed, it was the following week. It was the 28th. It was a very somber Thanksgiving that year. But I'm not sure how many times since then it's actually fallen on this holiday.
No, but I do remember, as you bring that up, the thought that immediately occurred to me is the fact that the National Football League still decided to go ahead and play their games that weekend.
Pete Rozelle said it was one of the, think of this, Friday Kennedy is killed. On Saturday when Oswald's killed, the NFL teams are taking the field that day. Pete Rozelle, who was then running the league as a commissioner, said afterwards that it was the greatest single mistake he made. If he had one thing to do over again or he regretted, it was that decision. It was stunning to think that happened.
Gerald, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
as always,
so
we'll talk with you again soon. Gerald right. Posner, author of the great book, Case Closed, and God's Bankers, so many more. Very talented investigative journalist.